All right, we will begin. So thank you again so much for your patience. Welcome to Sunstone. This is session 134, Mormon Studies in the Academy. We're going to be talking about a great topic and an important topic about as Mormon studies in academia grows. We've got some panelists with us. There is a correction to the printed program. Boyd Peterson, lucky him, is having knee surgery and is not here. He's been a great friend to Sunstone over the years, and so we hope he recovers completely. In his place, we have Dennis Potter from UVSC, and he'll be speaking on this topic as well. I'm a student, and so it's a topic of great interest to me, and look forward to hearing what everybody has to say. We have Seth Perry with us. Seth received his bachelor's degree from Georgetown University and a Master of Arts in Religious Studies from University of Chicago Divinity School. That's impressive, and anxious to hear what he has to say, and he's finishing a PhD there as well at University of Chicago Divinity School. Dennis Potter, again, teaches at UVSC. He's completed his master's degree in philosophy from the University of Notre Dame, and is a philosophy teacher down there. Also, one of the many stars of the great documentary, This Divided State, when Michael Moore came to UVSC to speak. You'll see Dennis there waving signs and being quite articulate in the face of lots of booing Sean Hannity fans. Laura Bush is at Arizona State University. She was at BYU Idaho, was Rick's when she was there. She's got a PhD in English and has written a marvelous book that I proudly own, Faithful Transgressions in the American West, which I'd encourage anybody to pick up. The subtitle is Six 20th Century Mormon Women's Autobiographical Acts, and it's a great book. Chuck Schofield is with us as well. He is actually at the Claremont Graduate School, taking two Mormon studies classes taught by Armin Moss right now, and so can speak to this. Claremont is one of the, if not the most important places where Mormon studies is happening, and as they try and get that program off the ground, and so he will illuminate us as well. Again, thank you for coming. We'll turn the time over to these folks, and they will illuminate us.
Computer use in the hotel's business center is $12 an hour, so I will be reading this from mine, having not used their printer. This was originally a coherent single piece, and now it's sort of a chopped down two pieces. So there was coherence. I had to cut a lot of coherence out for time. So here we go. People often assume I'm a Mormon. I study Mormonism, and as a vanilla white, clean-cut Midwesterner, I pretty well fit into the average person's mental picture of what a Mormon looks like. The response I get when I explain that my interest is purely academic and accidental depends on the person I'm talking to. Both non-Mormons and Mormons are intrigued, the former by Mormonism, the latter by my interest. Non-Mormons often become conspiratorial, ready to get answers to everything they've always wanted to know about Mormonism but were afraid to ask. Mormons, on the other hand, always take an interest in my interest, and often make an opposite and equally misguided assumption that it suggests an inkling toward conversion, or at least a desire to celebrate the faith from the outside. Rare is someone who assumes an unvarnished academic interest. From where I stand, as a young scholar looking to get into the field, challenges presented in these everyday conversations, generally the skepticism of outsiders and the faith promotion of members, are miniature versions of those endemic to the professional field of Mormon studies. They signal some of the questions of method and audience which loom large for a non-Mormon in the field. What I want to do here is elaborate my take on the perils of those two audiences and offer some thoughts on the ways in which I think that my scholarship and those of others like me will respond to those challenges. My own biggest challenge in studying Mormonism is making my scholarship relevant to outsiders and non-specialists. My advisor dutifully reminds me that if I expect to find an academic job, I need to assimilate my primary interest into the broader study of Christianity or of religion in America, since it may be a long, long time before a teaching position explicitly in Mormon studies will be available to an entry-level non-Mormon. Comparison, rather contextualization, of Mormonism then is part and parcel of getting into this field for me. which makes what I've highlighted here as voyeuristic tendencies among outsiders, among the people who are going to be my primary audience, a persistent concern. I don't have a lot of Mormonism in the classroom experience. We don't have, there's no Mormonism 101 at Chicago, but some classes have touched on things, and most of what I have to say in this part of the paper has to do with individual conversations informally. I spent a lot of time explaining Mormonism to fellow outsiders informally, which will be a major part of my career. If anything, I've learned anything so far about this, it's that proper presentation requires time and effort if it's not going to devolve into a handful of catchphrases which are themselves misunderstood and misappropriated as examples of oddity and deviance. This is perhaps true of explaining anything, particularly any religion. Students of non-Western religions have long dealt with this sort of essentializing or orientalizing and are profoundly sensitive to it. But in my experience, the degree of sensitivity in discussions of religion, and this certainly includes academic discussions of religion, is proportional to a religion's distance from Christianity and Judaism, the de facto points of reference for the vast majority of scholars, students, and random encounters I'm likely to deal with. It seems easier to approach different religious points of view when they are different on the scale of humanity, rather than only on the scale of one's own faith or environment. The very different speaks to the experiences of an alien history and culture, while the sort of different appears to some as an odd arrangement of the features of a world they know well. Those religions that are close to ours do things wrong, whereas religions that are very far from ours, people would tend to say do things differently. In my experience, the fact that Buddhism is essentially atheistic causes less consternation than the fact that Latter-day Saints believe in God but believe he has a body. Because of such incongruities between what people assume about Christian doctrine and some of the teachings of Mormonism, a number of people I've had these conversations with do not intuitively place Mormonism among the other things they evaluate as religions. I think my experience talking to non-Mormons about Mormonism is slightly different than that of members because people feel very free to start off asking me questions they might not ask a member right up front. I can report that there is very little of what I think we can fairly call anti-Mormon sentiment out there, at least in circles I move in. Very few people are openly hostile toward the faith. There is, though, commonly a note of whimsy, a little smile in the questions I get. These generally begin with money. Gosh, they sure are rich. The church sure is rich. Or something about Mormonism being the, quote, fastest growing religion in the world, something which everyone has heard and seems to find very important. Or a joke about plural marriage. Often this last one is something ribald directed at me. I'm engaged right now. Will Steph let you have another one? That sort of thing. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Most people I talk to are well aware that the church no longer sanctions plural marriage, but they also know that some people out west where the Mormons are still practice it, and this is confusing. Beyond such questions, I generally try to turn the conversation around. Do they know any members of the church? Almost without fail, this results in something about a friend or a coworker who has a lot of kids, doesn't see R-rated movies, and is really, really nice. These conversations are often difficult even among my fellow graduate students, a group that is supposed to be good at abstracting this sort of thing. I was in a class in which discussion of Mormon temple garments ended in someone in the class passing around drawings of them from an anti-Mormon website, which frankly astounded me. Analogous things would not happen in discussion of other religions, I think. A Jewish friend of mine once began berating me. That's another fun feature of being an interested outsider among outsiders, is that I end up representing the church very often, about the LDS conception of the office of prophet being set on what she conceived as a misappropriation of the Hebrew Bible's concept of prophet. So that was the first part about the voyeurism of outsiders. The other part I really want to talk about has more to do with this, with the field more broadly, and sort of focuses on what has been for me a paradigmatic example of the problems that are going to be encountered when talking about faith and scholarship, faith within scholarship as representations, outgrowth of faith. And for me, the example was at the Worlds of Joseph Smith Conference at the Library of Congress in May of 2005. At that conference, scholarship from some very insulated faith-based perspectives on matters such as archaeological proofs for the Book of Mormon, for example, shared the program with more widely accessible scholarship. Discussion over an early version of the paper, actually with Dennis here, has made me want to spend a minute clarifying what I mean by sort of faith-based perspectives and widely accessible with respect to what I think is admissible in religious studies as a discipline. Dennis has pointed out that religious studies as a rubric necessarily has a component requiring faith because categories like philosophy of religion and theology, what Chicago we would call constructive studies in religion, obviously fall under the rubric of religious studies. We teach in the same departments, we go to the same meetings. What I'm really talking about, I'm really speaking as an historian, and I'm really, and my concerns apply more broadly to what we could call the secular approaches. That's a terrible word, but let's all pretend that it means what we think it means for right now. Approaches to religious practices and thought which do not centrally concern the observer's religious beliefs, and this part concerned me most, do not require faith on the part of the audience for the arguments to be accessible and interesting. And this is anthropology and sociology, such things. I'm not really interested in archaeological proofs of the Book of Mormon in and of themselves, because I just don't, as they say, have a dog in that fight. Now, the abstract fact that such arguments have been made and believed or disproven, that could be interesting. At any rate, what I'm trying to draw attention to are the instances such as Douglas Davies' presentation at the Library of Congress. He gave a paper about Mormonism's future prospects from a sociological standpoint. His thesis, drawn from his more general theoretical work on how religions become world religions, was that as Mormonism grows, it will accommodate and adapt to the cultures it encounters. Otherwise, it will never really be a world religion. And one of the responses to it, on the other hand, was a faith-based assertion that the church's prospects are not really in question because of the singularity of Mormonism's revealed truth and the potent authority of the church's leaders. Davies was talking about how institutionalized doctrines and practices persist and change over time based on historical parallels and what we know about human behavior and things like that. The response was talking about how the divinely instituted church was destined to do the work of God in the world. Both views have their place, but that place isn't on stage next to each other. They don't have a lot to say to each other, and the second one isn't really what I signed up for in going to that session. It doesn't interest me that much. How long have I been going? Do I have a few minutes? The problems of faith and scholarship in the Mormon context are different from the other areas of religious studies, where member scholars are also the rule. This is not about members wanting to study their faith. That happens everywhere. Most scholars of Methodism are probably Methodist. I think that's fair enough to say. That happens everywhere. The problem it really has to do is not that Mormons want to be part of the academic study of their faith, but that their church, the definitive insider, wants to be a part of it. The church, this goes back to the point about scholarship as validation. The church seems to see scholarship as giving credence to the world religions and Christian bodies among which it wants to be counted. And so it pursues scholarship with this goal of validation in mind. The result is that where the church has had influence, the tone of scholarship engaging those outside the faith has sometimes been defensive and hortatory, seeking to display the religion to outsiders rather than engage them in academic discussion of it. Scholarship as validation is seen in some circles as the answer to the problem of voyeurism I've outlined above. I believe, however, that just the opposite is true. I think that the urge to bring faith-reliant scholarship into academic conversations is isolating, that it plays into the ghettoizing of this discipline by letting outsiders assume that this study is still by Mormons for Mormons. It discourages the comparative work and even-handed, non-polemical elaborations of the faith that I think are the only workable answers to the problem of voyeurism. At the bottom line, and sort of the takeaway, to use a phrase we heard last night if you're at the session, is that the problem with the mixture of faith and scholarship is the effect on the questions which are pursued and the sources which are used in scholarship. I think the framing questions are, what is interesting to a scholar? What evidence is admissible in the making of arguments? And who is the audience? And I think that those working from certain types of faith-based standpoints, and I'm not saying all faith-based standpoints are created equal, apologetic standpoints, where the goal of your scholarship is overtly apologetic, answer those questions in very different ways, and it impedes discussion among those who answer them without the influence of faith. I'll stop there. Thank you.
This is an ongoing conversation in Sunstone and elsewhere because of how recent of a fun topic to talk about it is. But because I sort of feel like the peon in this group, I wanted to try to figure out what I could add that hasn't already been added. I've heard Seth talk about this topic, and I've heard Dennis talk about this topic, and I had some idea what they might have said I agree with everything Seth said, although what I'm about to say may seem like I don't. Okay. But because of the time constraints of a panel discussion, I'm just going to make one very subjective, personal point. And what I will say today has more to do with being a Mormon in the academy studying Mormonism than with being an academic involved with Mormon studies in the academy. I could make that presentation, but I didn't think it would be unique today. I have feelings about that and everything, but I just want to stay on this one point. I thought that surely the reason why I was asked to be on this panel had something to do with me being a student at the Claremont School of Theology and the only student to take both classes offered so far on Mormonism by Armin Moss. He has added his voice also to this conversation. My experience is the only unique thing I have to offer. And as far as I can tell, the point I'm going to make has yet to be added to this conversation. I am a lifelong member of the church who would describe myself Orthodox, even if some of my family and friends would not. I also attend the Claremont School of Theology in their Master of Arts in Religion program. The Claremont School of Theology has a sister school relationship with the Claremont Graduate School, so that I can cross-register for the classes at the graduate school, like the two classes Armin Moss took, but only pay one-third the tuition. Yeah. So the following is a brief summary of my experience with the emergence of Mormon studies at Claremont. In the fall of 2003, I attended a lecture by Jan Shipps entitled Are Mormons Christians? This was the first time I had ever heard of Jan Shipps. That's important. In the fall of 2004, I attended the conference on positioning Mormonism within U.S. history and religious studies at Claremont. This is where I first met Dan Witherspoon. We discussed our similar experiences at Claremont, our similar love of David Griffin, as well as interests in process theology and religion and the environment. In the spring of 2005, I took the first class offered by Armin Moss entitled Mormons in the History of the American West, that looked at Mormonism from a historical perspective. Just to give a sense of the demographics of the class, one-third of the students in the class were LDS. Brad Kelly and I were the two Mormons. In the fall of 2005, I attended the conference on Joseph Smith and the prophetic tradition. And in the spring of 2006, I took the second class offered by Armin Moss entitled Mormonism from a Sociological Perspective, his forte. And again, the class was, ironically, one-third LDS. Finally, in April, I attended Sunstone West, also held at Claremont Grad School. So it is certainly a fun time to be a Mormon, or just happen to be a Mormon and happen to be at Claremont. I was not attracted initially to go to Claremont because of the Mormon Studies program, and I'm not pursuing that degree or that course now. But the blurb for this session says that the panel will discuss the challenges, tensions, and rewards of studying Mormon history, literature, and culture outside LDS-sponsored institutions with both member and non-members in students in the same classroom. One potential challenge for students of religion in general is that their belief system might be entirely undermined or deconstructed. This is what many warned me about theology school would do to me, or what theology school would do to me. Be prepared to have your whole world flipped upside down, they said. For a Mormon student studying Mormonism outside LDS-sponsored institutions, this can present a more acute form of this challenge. This has been the concern of many in the church and a motivating factor behind the current mission of the church education system. Fortunately, this has not been my experience. As far as I understand, the purpose of CES is to strengthen one's testimony so that when it meets challenges in the outside world, like ones in the academy, it will remain strong. I have the best I have had the best institute teachers ever and could not love and appreciate them more. I could not remain true to myself if I said anything bad about them or my experience with institute. However, by taking the current strategy of religious education only, or indoctrination, or only sharing the theological history, I feel as if it sought to strengthen my testimony in a vacuum. This vacuum was void of, among other things, pieces of our history that some would deem not faith-promoting. This limited approach leaves me vulnerable. Please don't hear me wrong. My entire institute experience did strengthen my testimony. It gave me more tools to use in Sunday school, family home evenings, in personal study, and amongst Mormon friends. It strengthened my testimony in general so that in the outside world it was able to withstand more. Unfortunately, it did not give me any tools with which to engage or have dialogue with the outside world or engage their arguments. As Armin Moss points out in The Angel and the Beehive, intellectual articulation and reconciliation with ideas from the outside world was at one time part of the vision of CES. However, in our current post-retrenchment context, it is not. I feel that this is bad. Fortunately, my experience at Claremont has given me the tools to engage the world using its language, its methods, its culture, and its arguments. It has given me the tools of history, philosophy, literary criticism, psychology, sociology, anthropology, and theology, among a host of others, to improve my own personal understanding of my faith and my own understanding of others. In an ironic twist, exposure to everything CES does not expose one to fulfilled the mission of CES to prepare me and my testimony for engaging the outside world. What adds to the irony is that strengthening testimonies is in no way part of the mission of or vision of Mormon studies in the academy, nor should it be, nor of the academic study of religion more generally. The desired results of the one were met by the unintended consequences of the other. That is the very subjective personal point that I want to make or add to this discussion today. Of course, how one is exposed to these things plays an important role. That is why the safe ground of the academy is the best place for this, as well as other forums where all voices are heard and academic integrity and honesty are sought. I still wonder what would have happened if my exposure to these things had been in the reverse order. What if my first exposure to these things were in the academy, and then I was exposed to the Mormon theological history via CES? What effect would that have had on my testimony, if any? I do not know, but what I do know is, or I do think that being exposed first to CES and then Mormon studies did two things for me. First, I believe that to a large degree, being exposed to the theological history via CES and other church experience, to some degree, prepared me for the second exposure. Secondly, what I think is more interesting is that CES and other church exposure actually made me crave and need what I eventually received in Mormon studies in the academy. So I question what happens when that craving is not met. I can say with certainty that everything I have ever been exposed to as I have studied religion in the academy has strengthened my testimony. I think that it was Leonard Arrington who said, "All history is faith promoting." So far, I have to agree. Obviously, I see this as one of the rewards of studying Mormonism outside LDS-sponsored institutions. To a degree, as a Mormon, everything I have studied in the academy has been Mormon studies in the academy. While some things have encouraged me, I know that's not what the technical definition is, but in this postmodern age, I have to admit my filter, right? While some things have encouraged me to change my worldview, nothing has hurt my testimony. If I were to make a prediction about the success of Mormon studies based solely on my experience, which is all I really can do, right? it would be optimistic and hopeful. The only reason I could see Mormons attempting to shut the program down or withdraw funding or whatever is if it hurt testimonies. But because it strengthened mine, I see no reason why any Mormon could justify withholding funds. No matter who was hired to be the chair or what they talked about, or if they were a homosexual feminist theologian who knew a lot of, who was very well qualified to teach Mormon studies. I couldn't see any reason why someone would try to withhold fundings or use their political clout to stop it if they thought about it. This is most likely as true for the Academy in general as it is for Claremont specifically. In preparation for this presentation, I went back through my notes for each of the classes I took with Armin Moss. And in each class, a couple times, I wrote just randomly, every member needs to take this class. What I think I meant by that was every member needs this exposure to be able to engage the outside world on its terms using its language, not solely for the purpose of conversion or proselytizing, but simply to be able to engage. Salt without the ability to engage, or salt's ability to engage with other flavors, is what gives it its flavor, its contrast. Salt without the ability to engage, or salt that has lost its flavor, is simply a group of small stones that do not enhance their surroundings. If we are to be the salt of the earth, we must have our flavor, which is that ability to engage with and have dialogue with and enhance the other flavors around us. That's all I have to start with.
I'm going to do three things briefly. One, tell you a little bit about my context at Arizona State University, and then get a little bit more particular about me and my history with doing Mormon studies, and then broaden it to what I think has already happened a little bit, the larger context of religious studies, the kinds of questions I think we need to be asking, and what's obviously evident, I think, here is how important each of our experiences are within this conversation, and how excited I am to be part of this conversation. And I think Chuck should feel quite important, not the, what did you call yourself? The peon of the group. Just gotta keep working on that, all right? Because each of us has something important to contribute here, and I know there are many of you out there who I'm interested in why you came to this session and what your contributions are to this particular movement even. So a little bit about Arizona State University. We're a very large public research university, of course, in Phoenix, and there's all those Mesa Mormons out in that valley. And their identity is very known, and there are many Mormon students on our campus. So we're a kind of secondary Mormon culture outside of Utah. And so the information, the knowledge that there are Mormons there is very pervasive. And one of our great largest donors is Ira Fulton, who lives in the valley, and who's also a huge donor to Brigham Young University. So that's important to know. The Mormon Institute building is actually on the same road as the building where the Department of Religious Studies is located. I myself am not in religious studies, but I have lots of colleagues who are. The department itself recognizes the significance of Mormon studies. At the time, right now, the department is not looking actively for a Mormon studies scholar, but we're interested in supporting Mormon studies at Arizona State. And the department sees it as highly desirable, not only for the culture, but for the influence of Mormonism in the region, the history of it in the Southwest, et cetera. The department has manifested its commitment to Mormon studies in a number of ways. There's a senior scholar at Arizona State who has taught Mormonism, a class of Mormonism, Richard Wentz. And then the colleague that I'm most closely connected with, Doe Daughtry, who's also on the Sunstone board, and getting her PhD at Arizona State University, has been developing and teaching a course called Current Issues in Mormonism, and she's taught the course 3 times, and I'll tell you just a little bit about that. I actually wish she were here so that I wasn't speaking for her, but she's doing so many things at Sunstone. Here I am representing Arizona State, and I will represent her. I worked with her and guest lectured in her course and the development of that course. There are PhD students doing work in Mormon studies and offering papers from Arizona State. And some of you may have attended or known that Arizona State in January 2005 just hosted the first Sunstone conference in the region, and it went very well. And there were at least 5 faculty members, senior faculty members from the Department of Religious Studies who participated in the Sunstone conference, and I think it was a great success, and we hope to continue it down there. Doe and I, myself, have actually were invited to come and present to the ASU Foundation, which is a large development and fundraising arm of Arizona State University. Because they work so closely with Ira Fulton, they wanted to know more about Mormons. And so we, in the spring of 2005, went and with the president's staff, gave them a presentation about Mormonism and question and answer, and that clearly indicated to me how important they believe Mormons to be and how influential and how respectful they want to be. But we also, you know, talked about the challenges and issues of Mormon influence on the campus and our own concerns about that as well. So let me tell you briefly about my own context, who I am, and how I position myself in Mormon studies in particular. I've personally had to grapple with issues about being a scholar of Mormon studies, first as a feminist scholar at Ricks College. And I'm sure most of you can see, even by my dress, there are particular signifiers that tell you something about where I was and where I am now, and that is I have left the church being a practicing member. But I was a very orthodox, believing person when I was a full-time faculty member in the Department of English at Ricks College. While there, I felt very strongly the surveillance and suspicion and had several different kinds of experiences that were quite disillusioning and distressing to me. And that led to me going on to get my PhD at Arizona State and write the book, Faithful Transgressions. I've had to grapple with these things very personally, and also as an academic scholar. I felt that surveillance. I had to undergo extra interviews to get continuing status at Ricks College, extra interviews about what I was and wasn't teaching in my classes. And truly, I know you can't know this for sure, but I was a very conservative feminist. And so I didn't have to do very much to raise suspicion because of other things that were happening in that history. I was teaching there from 1989 to 1994. That gives you some idea. I always knew that participating in Sunstone was really a no-no, that I should not be doing that. And I think there may be some lessening of that over the years. I know that there are people in Sunstone who are working to try to lessen those kinds of tensions, especially for people doing studies or doing academic work in Mormonism, not to feel so threatened or fearful about where they can or cannot publish. Once I worked through my book, I essentially understood that I would likely not get hired at BYU, even though when I first started my degree, my PhD, I had every intention of going back to BYU and bringing to young women and men there things that I did not have, access to knowledge, and perhaps access to the tools to engage the outside world that Chuck is talking about. But I knew with the publication of that book it was not likely, nor did I have any longer any desire to go back to a situation in which I felt it was a hostile environment, suspicion, and in ways that I could not speak, even as I was moderating my rhetoric, trying to be sensitive to both insider and outsider concerns. It grew to be too much for me. I needed to be able to work in a place where I had a feeling of academic freedom. So I no longer wanted to return there anyway. In around May 2000, and I'll be talking about this a little bit in a presentation I do on my creed, which I'm very interested in hearing what other people are saying about that on tomorrow, I did leave the church, and I felt a great sense of freedom by having done that. But unfortunately, and I'm getting close to the end of this, unfortunately, I've still seen evidences of that kind of fear in myself and other people who are doing this work. I've guest lectured in Doe's course and on refuge about issues of power and authority. Barber's, one of Phyllis Barber's chapter on Mormon women's sexuality that gets kind of illustrated in a chapter she calls Rose Night. And I've experienced what it's like to be in a classroom where there are both Mormons and non-Mormon students. And I can tell you a little bit more about those classrooms, but there's a particular tension often that Mormon students bring to that space, and so a teacher has to be prepared for that, the defensiveness, the paranoia, the kind of uncritical stance that can be ameliorated if you're thoughtful about that, and it happens in any kind of religious studies course, really, because often our religious background is personal to us. But there's something in particular that Mormon students often bring to that Mormon classroom. When the second example of the kind of concerns I've seen, I would like to teach a Mormon literature study course at ASU Polytechnic. My superiors are interested in that course, but the minute that I suggested it to them, I got clear emails back to them that if you teach this course, you must talk with us, though, about the particular nature of it. We have to know clearly what the objectives and descriptions are. And mainly, I found out their concerns, which made me harken back to this time when I was doing things at Ricks College. It brought up those fears again. It wasn't that they didn't want me to do the course, but that they felt that they needed to know exactly what the course was going to be in order to represent it to outsiders who may question it, what's going on in that course. So they're very much aware of the Mormon presence and its influence. So let me get very quickly then to the larger context, and I think then the questions that we should be asking ourselves as we go forward, and I think that this is an exciting time for Mormon studies. This discussion really connects to the larger discourse about the relatively new development of religious studies in higher education over the past 30 years and how people understand the study of religion, any religion. I'm not a member of a Department of Religious Studies myself, but I work closely with friends and colleagues who are. My book contributes to the field of religious and Mormon studies, even though I write it primarily from the perspective, theories, and methodologies of a literary critic. As I understand religious studies itself, and I know this is a rudimentary understanding, I know there's complications to be made over here, this field is not about studying religion to produce religious persons, or even perhaps, in a very strict sense, to produce religious understanding, although that may be one desirable outcome. Instead, religious studies is the academic study of religion for the purpose of examining, comparing, and critiquing religion in its many and varied forms. As such, religious studies contributes to broad understanding about the social and cultural nature of human beings and their interactions over time. Distinguishing between the academic study of religion and the study of religion to achieve religious purposes is central to understanding why religious studies, and Mormon studies in particular, is fraught with the potential for tension and controversy. People's religions are important to them and usually quite personal. The challenge for religious studies and thus for Mormon studies scholars is to examine and compare religions with both significant respect and knowledge, but also with vigilant and responsible critique. So I think that we have to ask questions about what institutions and departments do in order to integrate Mormon studies. And then as teachers within those classrooms, we have pedagogical questions to ask in order to anticipate potential tensions, problems, and ways of being, both of our students and of us in our own classrooms, because of course, Seth's teaching Mormonism in a non-Mormon environment with just a couple of Mormon students will be a different context, and there will be different issues that come up than I, as a non-practicing former Mormon. When do I reveal that? How do I reveal that? How do my students respond to that or not? What kind of a climate does that set within my classroom? So these are some questions I think to ask, and then I think Dennis Potter will add to those questions and continue. What kind of influence does the church manifest in secularized society, especially in secular academic settings? What is at stake for a scholar of Mormon studies to do this work at a state and non-Mormon institutions? How do you do academic study of a religion that manifests an authoritarian, dogmatic, totalizing, and paranoid streak so strong that it has actually developed a formal mechanism like FARMS to process and defend its own paranoia? That particular question came from a colleague of mine who's very interested in Mormon studies, but who's seeing this from an outsider position. And he also is the one who has to often approve or not courses from BYU in religion, whether they will transfer or not to ASU. So if you have a course in Bible studies or in the Old Testament at BYU, do you accept that course as a course in their Department of Religious Studies? Quite frankly, he's not likely to accept it because he has suspicions about what it means to take Old Testament at BYU and what it means to take the Old Testament and do an academic or scholarly view of it, take on it. So what are those issues? And then what are the teaching philosophies and strategies that need to be in place for successful teaching, especially when there are significant numbers of Mormon students? What do you title the course? What kind of climate setting activities? How do you ensure students understand and operate according to the distinction between producing religious persons or not? And then finally, I wanted to mention this final question. Who is doing Mormon studies, and how does that look different or not if the scholar is a member or non-member, excommunicated or not, practicing or not? What are the implications? What can we learn about the progress of Mormon studies moving into academic settings by examining the career paths and scholarly choices of people like Fawn Brody, Jan Shipps, Lori Mathley Kipp, Michael Quinn, Ann Taves, Seth Perry, Doe Daughtry, or even me? Thank you.
I will just make 3 points. Oh no, you know what? I'm coming up for tenure in the fall, so actually I'm not going to finish. That's actually my first point. The money, where the money comes from, is going to affect directly the content of how Mormon studies proceeds. And that doesn't have any, I don't see any difference between a private institution and a state institution in that regard. And let me give you an example. I'm at Utah Valley State, a state institution funded by the government here in Utah. And so the funding decisions are made by state legislators here in Salt Lake, and some of them, people on the Higher Education Committee, are conservative Mormons. And they know what's going on at UVSC now that Michael Moore came there. And they're watching it, and as a result, 2 years ago when I organized the Mormonism and Social Justice Conference, not because someone called up and said, hey, we're worried about the content of this conference, you need to change something, but just because there was the possibility of that, our non-Mormon president of the school invited me to come to his office, and we had a 2.5-hour conversation about the content of this conference, which is a completely inappropriate act in academia. He should not have been talking to me about the content of this conference. That's a violation of academic freedom. Just talking to me about it in the first place and questioning it, that's a violation of academic freedom. And we were forced in the end to change titles and to add speakers in order to give the conference the sense of it being more moderate. Now, I mean, if I really, really wanted tenure, I wouldn't have told you that. I think I still might get it, but I think it's more important to tell the truth than to preserve your place. But there's not everyone agrees with me, and politics are abound in academia more than anywhere else. And so those who fund us will affect the content. And that is going to be the biggest problem, I think. Especially where there are powerful Mormons like Ira Fulton who are conservative politically and orthodox. They're going to affect the content because they're going to be giving the money. And I don't think you're going to get away from this. And so we've got to be vigilant, and we've got to attack them at every point we can to stop. Every time there's any inkling that there's that kind of an effect on the content of Mormon studies, we've got to be there to make it public and make a big deal about it, make a big stink about it. That's my first point. My second point is rather less radical, I think, in certain ways. I think that Mormon studies, and I think that generally religious studies should be this way as well, and I think this is a minority position. It should include, not be exclusively, but include unabashedly faithful and apologetic perspectives. I don't think there's anything wrong in religious studies with the kind of perspective, for example, that George Marsden has in the history department at the University of Notre Dame, or Alvin Plantinga. I think that needs to be there. There needs to be people who say, look, I'm doing history, I'm doing philosophy or theology, I'm doing anthropology, and, you know, I admit it, I'm a faithful believer in this certain tradition, and when I do my history, that affects the way I interpret those facts. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being a Christian historian or being a Mormon theologian or being a Mormon anthropologist. And that's kind of a controversial point. I know that Seth and I don't totally agree on this, and I know that I disagree a lot with probably the average member of the AAR on that point, the American Academy of Religion. But this means something else. There's a flip side to that coin. It sounds like a very conservative point. Okay, let farms into the academy. No, the flip side is, this means criticism too. This means if we're going to allow apologetics and defense and perspectives that are unabashedly faithful and defensive, of which I consider almost all of my work to be apologetics, we've got to allow the criticisms too. There need to be hard looks at religious faith, religious doctrines, religious histories that are very critical, that are revisionist, that we need every voice there involved in that discussion. I'm really suspicious when people say, oh, well, we should only do a dispassionate, objective, non-committed look at a religious tradition from the outside and, you know, some sort of... I just don't think that anyone's really capable of doing that. We're coming from some perspective, a secular one or a religious one, and I think that we ought to just go ahead and embrace that fact and do that. But that means we have to accept the criticism. We can't have our cake and eat it too. We can't think that it's okay to make the arguments, for example, trying to defend the Book of Mormon, we're using archaeology, and then when the similar scientific arguments concerning DNA come along, ignore them and say, oh, well, no, you guys shouldn't be doing that. That's anti-Mormon. That is to be inconsistent. So if we're going to accept the faithful apologetic perspectives, we have to accept the critical perspectives as well as part of the discourse. And this brings me to my third point. We need to get over this anti-Mormonism paranoia. We're constantly labeling people anti-Mormons. You might call this the circling the wagons syndrome, because I think it really is it goes back to our pioneer days, you know, the persecution complex that we have. We're not being persecuted anymore. Quit it. We don't need to label everyone who criticizes the church as anti-Mormon. And any definition that we try, all of my friends who argue with me about this say, well, no, there's a difference between criticism and being anti-Mormon. And we can nuance that definition in such a way that we can account for critical scholarship and eliminate what would be anti-Mormon scholarship. But I've looked at these definitions, and I just don't think that they'll ever hold up. I think there will always be counterexamples. There will always be cases of scholarship that fall into the class of so-called anti-Mormon literature as soon as you come up with one of these definitions. And I'll give a case in point. Frank Beckwith is a philosopher, an evangelical Christian who's a philosopher at UNLV and wrote a very fine philosophical piece. It's a good piece of scholarship. I mean, I don't agree with most of it. I think most of the arguments fail, and I argue against them in some of my work. However, all he does in it is just attack at every point the Mormon concept of God. And he does it in a tone. His tone is even pretty negative. And he was involved in trying to keep Mormons out of the Society of Christian Philosophers. He was doing that. And so in his own life, in his activities, he acts in a way that anyone would categorize him as an anti-Mormon, but he's a legitimate part of the Academy. He's a voice that we have to accept, and we need to just get thick-skinned and quit being such wimps about it in the Mormon community. Oh, my students are constantly labeling me as anti-Mormon, and yet all of my published work is all apologetic. It's all defense. And yet they think I'm anti-Mormon because I'm willing to bring up criticisms. This is paranoia. And I think we need to get over that. We need to have thick skins. Oh, and now I'll just leave it at that.
We have plenty of time for questions. I'll start off with the first really quickly for all of you kind of leaping off of Dennis's point. And that simply is, if a Mormon is at, a non-LDS university and sees Mormon classes, they're going to be interested, I think, and we've heard that, and they're going to want to take them. Are Mormon students ready for Mormon studies, is my question. Do they come at it interested in the phenomenon that is Mormonism, or do they come at it wanting to be validated and then getting frustrated and upset when they're not validated? And take this off and pass it around.
We can just go ahead.
Okay.
It's not coming.
I can't really speak to that. Like everything else, Chicago is a skewed sample. The Mormons I've known in Chicago are very open and are very faith affirmed and everything, but I feel that they're much more Sunstone than might be standard, but yeah. Generally speaking, I think absolutely, and I see a lot a handful of members I've seen in classes really wanting to take an active part in explaining and being part of the discussion where professors lapse, but also being very open to all sorts of discussion in the classroom.
I've taught Mormon cultural studies at UVSC. And philosophy of religion, and excuse me. My experience is that the students are ready for it. Usually, I do have some problems every once in a while. The students are ready to look at their own religion in an academic way. Generally speaking, what's interesting too is I think the scholars at BYU are ready, even in the religion department, for the most part. For example, when the president at Utah Valley State brought me in to question this conference. The religion department that same day, the religion department at BYU, had a meeting that same day to talk about whether or not people in the department should be allowed to attend this conference down at UVSC. And they voted overwhelmingly that yes, even though we had the program that we sent to them included words like feminism and gay. And they voted overwhelmingly that it was okay to attend this conference at Utah Valley State. So there's a lot of hope in those cases. However, I think that the politically powerful people, the wealthy people in Utah at least, that happen to be conservative and Orthodox Mormons, they're not ready. And they are worried. And they're constantly suspicious. And I think that they have a major voice, and so that's where we have to be concerned. I'm not as concerned about Bob Millett, for example, or Richard Holtzoffel in the religion department at BYU as I am about Kurt Bramble or Chris Butters, who would like to have an effect, or Kay Anderson, for example, from This Divided State, the wealthy slumlord, right, that was all upset about Sean Hannity, or he should have been upset about Sean Hannity coming. He was upset about Michael Morfin. Those are the people that I think are not ready for it. It's not the students. The students are ready for it. They like it when they get it, usually.
Hey, Brad. Yes or no? Were you ready for it?
My experience was a lot more...
Yes or no, Brad? Yes or no? Just yes or no? You can do it.
I can't just say a one-word answer. My experience was a whole lot more deconstructed than Chuck's was. And maybe that's because I'm a convert and not because I think a lot of converts come in like guns blazing to the church and we're really excited to be there. And a lot of that got deconstructed. But I also had a similar experience that Chuck did, that I was built back up even more Mormon than before. And I think that... Yeah, I think that we need it. I think that I have the same note that you do. Every person needs to sit in this class. I'm actually excited to, I just ran into someone that says that they're excited to see young people here. I'm excited to see old people here at Sunstone, because from our perspective, maybe me and Chuck sometimes feel like we're the only ones, probably because we're at a school of theology, at a Methodist school, we feel like we're the only ones. But it's I think it's encouraging to see some of the old guard, maybe someone that's, you know, twice my age, that's at a Sunstone conference. That's encouraging to me. My son is certainly going to be brought up with exposure at home, and probably I'm sure your kids are too. So I think we're ready.
And I think I said I was. So that's two.
Two people are ready.
Great. I'll keep this brief. I actually think Mormon students are ready. They're eager and interested. But it's really important the kind of context that a teacher sets up in the classroom and being able to respond to the kind of dynamics that inevitably occur. Even though a class like Current Issues in Mormonism is not labeled Mormonism 101, every class having to do with Mormonism usually has to have some basic Mormonism taught for people to be able to engage with the text. You can do all sorts of things as a teacher to do that, but often what happens in a classroom is if there's not some kind of information that non-Mormons need, then Mormons come to the rescue or come to the defense, and it starts to be all about Mormonism. Often, the class can be digress in that way. Or if you have, as Doe did in her recent class, a very recently returned missionary who was quite vocal and quite aggressive about defending the church from his own just psychological position too, and it was, and that comes into play, different personalities, and you just have to anticipate, keep setting it up in your syllabus, keep setting it up in the context of the class itself. Mormons are very bright people. I love that about my Mormon students. They're always engaged, intelligent. I haven't found that not to be very true, that they come from a background of really hard work and study and commitment.
I want to ask Dennis a question, because I always love what Dennis has to say, and I enjoyed what you said on this panel at the Sunstone West. In your presentation, you predicted that the program at Claremont this time would fail. And that it would fail this time, not because academia wasn't ready and not because the students weren't ready, but because the Mormon community and those providing the funds weren't ready. I just want to pose a hypothetical question. And I can only speak about Claremont, right? I can't speak about any other program. But if the result of any Mormons that happen to be involved with this program is the same result as the two Mormons that have been involved with this program, do you still feel that the community and the fundraisers are not ready and that it would fail?
Well, I may have said that it would fail, but I need to be clear about what I mean by fail. I think they're gonna hire someone to be a chair of Mormon Studies there. I mean, that's gonna happen. But Is it going to be in the same way that we do other academic chairs and positions? In other words, is it going to be the best candidate academically? And what I wonder about is the ability for it to be that, especially since it's named after a former president of the church. Could you imagine Michael Quinn as the Howard W. Hunter chair of I'm sorry, people would be upset. People who are giving the money, I know, are not progressive Mormons, or non-Mormons, right? And so they're going to at least think that they have some kind of control over who is going to be hired. I don't think that they will have they won't have a direct say in the sense of having a vote about who's being hired. But there's this thing that we call in academia the chill effect. And that comes from the fact that pressure has been applied in the past. And as a result of the pressure that's been applied in the past, we are tentative about doing things that are risky now because we're afraid of that. I guarantee you the students at UVSC are not going to bring Ward Churchill to come and speak at UVSC after the Michael Moore experience. Even if they wanted to, that's just not going to happen. That's the chill effect. And what I'm worried about is we have a chill effect already in the Mormon community. I mean, I'm actually scared shitless about what I said earlier. That it's on the I'm going to get that tape because I'm afraid now. You know, I mean, we have a chill effect, right? That keeps us from saying some of the things, doing some of the research that we would like to do. And it's a very technical sense of the word failure that I use the word failure. I didn't mean that they're not going to have a program. But I think a truly successful program is one where it's pursued in complete academic freedom.
I appreciate that definition of failure. I just can't, I don't want to believe that we're that immature to, what is their desired result? Is their desired result to have a chair? Or is their desired result to protect whatever they think they feel like they need to protect? And if it's protected, you know, who cares who's there? Who cares? But I still like everything you said.
Well, that's good. As a graduate of a master's program at ASU and a recent purchaser of a Ira Fulton home in Fulton Park, I find myself kind of torn by many issues that were raised in this presentation. And as a guy who just married a fairly doctrinaire Republican spouse, I feel like, and I live in Mesa as well. You made some comments about Mesa. I'm in a Mesa ward in the middle of a sunny Mesa ward. It sounds like a retirement home, but that's the name of it. This is kind of a little bit off the beaten path. Now that I'm in a career outside of academia as a government regulator and had a chance to work as a stockbroker and have means independent of academia, it's given me a different perspective. I realize that most of these institutions' business considerations are just, you know, obviously fact of life. We see our president cozying up to Ira Fulton. The church gives him a personal secretary. I had a chance to talk to one of his grandsons, who is pretty dismissive of a lot of his faithful boosterism. He says he believes with his wallet. That's basically the kind of character he is. But these are the people you contend with, and I don't think academic arguments are really all that impressive to them. They have something else at stake, which is perpetuating a certain sensibility in the Mormon community, and they don't want to see that undermined by academic freedom. When you say you need to fight these people, how do you even do it when you don't have the money or the power? One of my great heroes in philosophy, O.C. Tanner, who continued to pursue philosophy as a part-time professor at the University of Utah, discovered really early on that in order to have true intellectual freedom, he needed to be wealthy. and have power to engage. And of course, he had the power to go up against people like Butters or whoever. And I'm just wondering, what is the plan there? I mean, hopefully there might be some way you could prevail upon them that, hey, this stuff in the long run will be good for the Mormon community, although there may be fits and starts, and there's gonna be people who will be offended. As a matter of fact, that happens in any type of academic institution, especially when you're studying religion, you're gonna have that problem. But I just don't know if it's enough. You know, when you say fight them, what's the way to fight them? What kind of allies do you have that have money and power and political ability? How do you, engage those people in the process? What's the long-term strategy? Because if it's going to be successful long-term, you're going to have a strategy in that sense, as well as just fighting for academic freedom in the academy.
Dennis will do the follow-up and tell you the truth. Well, I think fostering scholars' careers is important, and I very much appreciate your pinning, and I think Dennis has too, power at where it really matters often, in the money. And I do think there are people who are cautious, and there are things, not only the chilling effect, but both overt and covert things that go on behind closed doors that we don't know about. And there are ways in which individual people like myself and others have received explicit and implicit messages about how to guide their careers or not. And unfortunately, those kinds of things go on, and we know it. So what I think that we need to do, and I think that that's why I value this conversation at Sunstone, why I valued my membership in the Sunstone-like community when I was a faculty member at Ricks College, is that scholars like I, like I am, inside and outside the church, need support. They need support from other intellectuals. They need administrative support. We have no formal structure for doing that right now. I think that there is no formal strategy. People have to get engaged enough in the idea. There may be ways in which we should be funding people's scholarship, funding people. I mean, if you followed Michael Quinn's particular career and others, what are we doing to fund those kinds of careers outside of maybe something like what is happening at Claremont, where we get a position that is attached to a very orthodox member? How can we do those kinds of things? And what kinds of conversations can we foster at places like this where we can begin to develop allies? And I think that that's important, so that we be in conversation with each other and support one another. And then I finally want to say to someone like Chuck, it matters what the students ask for at a university. So you matter. You are not just a peon. Your voice, if enough students say, we want Mormon studies, we're Mormon students, we're ready, bring it to us. Start asking for classes, getting your peers to take classes and have that conversation, have the kind of real scholarship and classroom experiences that perpetuate that and make the people know that it's something desirable.
In answer to your question, I think we need to speak about it. Whenever we find out about a threat to academic freedom, we need to be very public in our opposition to it. I mean, we don't have the money, academics don't have the money and the power always. Sometimes they do, O.C. Tanner, but what we can do is we can talk about it, and we can win the fight sometimes. Ward Churchill kept his job, and Cornel West got hired at Princeton when he fought Harvard, and it is possible to speak truth to power and sometimes win in the face of that. And I think we just need to do it often. As academics, and this is going a little bit beyond the scope of this session here, but we need to be looking at what David Horowitz is trying to do to academic freedom in the academy. And David Horowitz could easily be co-opted by the Mormon right in Utah, and they could try to push that on UVSC because of how they perceive UVSC to be so liberal. And if that were to happen, that would be disastrous for UVSC. So we need to fight Horowitz.
My question is for Chuck, though perhaps other panelists would want to respond as well. You give a very impassioned defense of the value of studying Mormonism from an academic perspective over against an attitude which might see that as potentially threatening to testimony. My question to you is, why do you feel a need to make that defense? Is it because you perceive that that kind of fundamentalistic spirit is alive and well in Mormonism? And that's a loaded question, because if the answer is yes, then it raises for me the possibility that Claremont's ability, or any school's ability, to have a Mormon studies program that maintains academic credibility, but at the same time manages to satisfy a community as fundamentalistic as your presentation implies, those prospects don't seem very good.
It was a loaded question, and my main motivation for wanting to share that, when I could have chosen to share something about any of the other rewards or benefits or challenges or tensions that I've seen and experienced at Claremont, is because I hadn't heard it yet. I felt all voices are needed, and I hadn't heard that voice yet, and because I could authentically give that voice, I gave that voice.
First of all, I just got back from a conference in Latin America, so I have to do a Latin American thing. I applaud you guys for your presentations. I really appreciate the conversation and the discussion. I think it's timely and important. And uh, I I have a comment I'd like responses to it. I know the conversation right now has been heavily around the issue of Claremont and around the issue of Mormon studies as an academic program. But I think that there are some other issues here. First of all, in the Spanish-speaking world, Spanish and Portuguese-speaking world, there are quite a number, there's been a huge fluorescence of religious studies, really huge. And it has conquered institutional spaces within the field of anthropology. It's quite large. Throughout that world, there are people who are tackling Mormon issues, who are studying Mormonism, and who are building academic careers as people who study Mormonism. The interesting thing is, generally, they don't just study Mormonism. But nonetheless, they're studying Mormonism. As I look out, a person who's now, you know, mid-career, I see quite a number of people in the U.S. Academy who are also in institutions, disciplines, Mormon, non-Mormon, who are tackling the issues of Mormonism and who are building careers occasionally or sometimes heavily writing about Mormonism. And I find that very intriguing and interesting, and I think that's somewhat of a separate issue from the issue of a program at Claremont, where you do have the issue of funding and the kind of political power of funding. Because I think, Dennis, that mitigates in some ways the issue of that we faced at UVSC. And in, you know, thinking about your issue of tenure, I was up for tenure right during that conference, and you may remember that some of us sat in a meeting and accused the president of not telling the truth very openly and publicly around academic freedom, around his intervention in Yale's affairs. And I was actually surprised a couple of months later to receive the letter awarding me tenure, after having publicly told the president that he wasn't telling the truth. Very different from the experience at BYU. But I think that, you know, there's some opening. The politics are difficult and they have to be fought, whether it's the politics of curriculum and working with curriculum committees, whether it's the politics of engaging your students and the various student interests and trying to build a base. I really appreciate what you said, Laura, because dealing with your students and establishing a meaningful, safe place to think about Mormon issues is important, no matter what the variety of perspectives students bring to the agenda. So I guess what I'm saying is that I think that there is quite a lot of hope that's developing just because of the number of people who are interested in Mormonism. And I think that translates out into presence and power. And I think in some ways, one thing I'd like to add, and then you can, I'd love to hear your comments, is that there's an importance to avoid a kind of parochialism. And that's part of why I bring up the Spanish-Portuguese. There's a parochialism of English, but there's also a parochialism of Mormon studies. And it's really necessary that we be engaged with broader intellectual academic issues, because the real battles are not in Sunstone. The real battles are the American Academy of Religion, the American Anthropological Association. I mean, the fact that a few years ago we had an entire panel on anthropology of Mormonism was supported by the Association for the Anthropology of Religion, Society for the Anthropology of Religion, I think is very important. They support the work and push it forward. And so, anyway, I'll leave it there, and perhaps you have comments. Thank you.
One comment about this. One parochialism that I have noticed is that, for example, in the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology, I've noticed this a little bit, which is a new forming society supposed to be analogous to the Society of Christian Philosophy, is that a lot of times when we talk about Mormonism, and this is not what you mentioned exactly, but it's similar, we only talk about the LDS Church. And I think that Mormon fundamentalists in Utah and other places, I think that's a very interesting religious phenomenon. And with that new television show, I think we're starting to see that it's not quite what we maybe thought it was. And I think that Mormon studies ought to be studying, ought to be looking at the wider range of how the Joseph Smith Restoration manifests itself in all sorts of different ways, and not just the LDS Church and just the LDS community.
I speak as one who's a member of the Council on Mormon Studies at Claremont, and I've been very close to the process of creating that program and creating the foundation, which is collecting the funds and is designing the nature of the position that we expect that will be occupied. And a great deal of what's been said here about the dominance of fundamentalist thinking among the people that are being expected to put up the money and the like doesn't bear any resemblance to what I know about what's going on, or about the people that are being solicited, I mean, conservative is one thing. Even that doesn't mean narrow-minded, and it certainly doesn't mean fundamentalist. Nor are all of the people that we are looking to for funds in any sense to be considered even conservative. There are lots of motives that people would have who are interested in promoting a greater image of respectability for Mormons and Mormonism in the world at large, and they need not be people who are circling the wagons or trying to protect the Mormon image. I think a lot of what I heard today comes out of the Utah or Arizona experience, where the politics are much sharper and maybe more vicious than they are in California, where Claremont is. And I would like to add further that the whole question about how politics gets into the selection of people for positions strikes me as one-sided in the discussion so far. I spent 30 years on the faculty at a Western research university, and I saw politics constantly being exerted in favor of whatever was the current fashionable academic attitude toward this or that rights movement. And furthermore, it was equally vicious. All kinds of people with great academic credentials were screened out because they didn't have politically correct views. And furthermore, this was made possible not because some rich people were supporting a program. This was made possible with the way public funds were allocated. And if public funds have the potential to be subverted in that way by political correctness, I don't think we need to worry that much about how somebody being hired in Mormon studies is going to have his funding perverted by some kind of unwholesome influence from conservatives and fundamentalists.
Armand, what I appreciate about your comments is I think that they show how complex this issue is, and whatever bias there might have been happening up here, I think is as real as your experience. And I really, it's very encouraging to me to have this field of Mormon studies become more complex, to become richer. It's very encouraging to me when I read the article that Seth published in the Chronicle of Higher Education, in which he was talking about his experience as a person doing Mormon studies to a very broad audience, not just to those of us within the Department of Religious Studies who are interested in Mormons in some ways. His piece, I know, got out there bigger, and he was doing things that were bigger and important, and so I appreciate that perspective. And that's what I think is so valuable and important about the work that we're doing here and the conversation that's going on, so that we really see the complexity of it and don't get parochial and don't get narrow about what's happening, that we see all of these stories and understand and influence them. Because I think it's as important as hearing us as it is for you, Armand, to have stood up here, or David Knowlton, to have stood up here and said, this is my experience, this is the expertise that I bring to this conversation, and this is how I hope to influence and move it forward. So I appreciate that.
A couple months ago, I got an acceptance letter from Claremont Graduate University, and I was ecstatic at first and thought about taking it, but I ended up rejecting it for a few reasons. One of the reasons was an Associated Press article about D. Michael Quinn and his sort of inability to get a job anywhere. And Ann Tavs, she mentioned that he would not be considered for a position at Claremont. And so beyond just the Claremont, it got me thinking about the job prospects for anybody who is seriously or completely dedicated to the study of Mormonism, to the exclusion of perhaps other disciplines. So my question, primarily to Seth and then towards others, is do you worry about your own job prospects in the field of Mormon studies?
Yes. At this stage, when you've invested too much time in a PhD program to want to try and do anything else, the worry about getting the actual job at the end of it all is the only thing I worry about. But not inordinately, I don't think. I feel really confident that I will fit well in a history department or in an American studies department, religious studies department. My exams cover the history of Christianity broadly, so I'll be qualified to teach, you know, from the beginning, to today, with a focus on American religious history, and then specifically on the LDS Church. When I get to the point where I can insert that myself into classes as I want to. While I'm up here, I just wanted to comment on sort of the general sense of worry about the funding of the field, and I understand. I think that my experience is very different, being from a different region. I think there is sort of a regional element to this, and I think that schools in Utah and Arizona have concerns this has been really interesting to me, all of this, because the worries about where the money comes from, that's everywhere in academia. No different than politics, like water on pavement. The money is always a problem. You're always going to worry about where it came from. All areas that we have that. Jewish studies chairs have exactly the same problems, exactly the same issues to contend with. Hindu studies is a big one right now. Buddhist studies, even. There are a lot of Tibetan Buddhist organizations that want to fund chairs different places. That just happens. And, what will happen with that, I think, and the way that gets solved, and this is sort of my attitude about everything, which annoys people sometimes, is that it'll work itself out. I think that the ground where it gets worked out is who fills the chairs. And there's been a lot of talk about, it's not going to be D. Michael Quinn at Claremont. And I am on the front lines also of promoting him as accomplished as anyone out there, as any candidate for it. But I also know that there are many other good candidates for it. And I know that one of them will get it. And I know that that person will not be beholden in a crass sort of way to the way the money works. I mean, it's not as if the person who fills this chair has to begin, revising the whole story and tearing down borders and all of this stuff in order to do what academic propriety demands. What that person has to do is be an honest scholar of their field. And I think that Claremont will hire the best person that they feel for that job. And there are lots of people that could be, and that it's going to work out well at this point, I think. So that's, I just wanted to throw that in there as the sort of moderate view. There is one.
My question is, after hearing sort of the feeling I was coming out of here that we have this big brother problem that we need to deal with, and then Armin Moss's comments, which I think there's total validity to both, it really gives me the feeling that for this to succeed, it hinges tremendously on people like Seth. My question is, what have you done, what can we do, or what could be done to encourage more people in the academy to seek out focusing on something like Mormon studies? I mean, you seem like kind of the renegade out there. What can we do to support that movement?
Again, it'll work itself out. I think that that interest is just there, there are lots of sort of academically crass reasons why there are a shortage of religions that haven't been overstudied, or areas of certain religions haven't overstudied. I think that lots of people will be turning their attention to that. When this article came out in the Chronicle, I sort of felt like I was the only one out there, non-member, who was interested or whatever, but people came out of the woodwork emailing me, being like, I'm an art historian, I'm into Mormonism, I'm into Mormon movies, and that's what I study, all of whom were not members. So that's happening, and it's going, the thing is that, when I say about being, in a different place sort of regionally, is that those things are going to happen, and the papers are going to start showing up at AAR, whether or not they show up at BYU-sponsored conferences and that sort of thing. You know what I mean? Like, that's going to be a different thing. And those are all issues to worry about. But I think that outside of all of these sort of direct confrontational issues, there's the fact that there are just interested non-members in various fields all over the place who are going to show up.
Seth, can we get the email addresses of those people? We'd like to send
you. Sure, absolutely.
I just have a quick question. I was wondering, Are the students showing up for the classes? I think that's one thing we've omitted here. Is any, you know, if the class, does anybody show up to it in the Mormon studies?
Well, this was a graduate level class offered only twice at Claremont now. There were two Mormons and four Mormons, or four non-Mormons in the first class. And they all showed up, sure, every time. And there was one Mormon and two non-Mormons in the second class. I don't know to take that as good or bad or what, but Armin Moss did an incredible job of offering all different aspects of Mormonism, everything that came from the Restoration, all branches, very academic. I don't know if we could, the success of it could be attributed solely to him, or if we need him to teach all the future classes on it. I don't think he'd be willing to do that, but they're showing up.
Can you afford to have a class with three students?
Can you afford to have a class with three students? In the religion department at Claremont, perhaps that's why the tuition's so high. But that's more common than not, unfortunately.
Before we get off this question, I just want to answer because I'm the other person that also took the classes. In all honesty, my wife would not let me take the second class because of the type of professor that Armin Moss is. The way that a class with Armin Moss is like, that's your only class that you have. So your workload is about equal to your other five classes put together. In all honesty, in all pragmatic sense, I think if someone else had taught it, it would have been, we would have seen the attendance go up, but I think I certainly put the word out that if that's either the only class you take or you better be an academic all-star before you step into his classroom. But I think that's at Claremont. I think if another professor had taught it, we'd have seen it go from 6 to 12 and then 12 to 20. Not that I'm saying that we need to make these dumb them down at all. There should be a lot of scholarship. There is a lot of reading involved, especially if you're going to catch people up for the last 200 years. In Mormon studies, but I think that that's why we saw that at Claremont, just because he's a difficult gentleman to take.
Should have been an 8-unit class.
Yeah. 8.
Thank you for coming. We're going to stop the tape, but it is the lunch hour. Feel free to stay here and mingle and ask questions. Thank you.